The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We have been running a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters for the last couple years, and the phone number has recently changed. You can now reach us at 438-858-6116. We would like to thank Fed Phone Line for providing us with this number for free. They wanted us to tell you that they help save money to inmates, family, and friends by reducing the cost of collect calls. For more information about their company, you can go to fedphoneline.com. So again, our new number is 438-858-6116. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison at that number. As always, we're an all-volunteer collective and don't always manage to answer the phone. If you can leave a message, please do. If you are calling Collect and we don't pick up, try again next time you can get to the phone. And again, our phone number is 438-858-6116, and you can call us Collect from Riviere de Prairie Prison or Bordeaux Prison.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the occupied West Bank, where Palestinians staged a general strike Sunday after Israeli forces killed at least 14 people during a raid that lasted more than 50 hours in the Nur Shams refugee camp near the city of Tulkarm. The residents of Nur Shams said the Israeli siege left the refugee camp uninhabitable.
Seeing it is not like hearing about it. You can see with your eyes what happened. Destruction. Gaza number two. What happened is that they left no trees, nor people, nor stones. It is unbearable, uninhabitable by humans. What happened is destruction. Destruction. They turned the camp into something uninhabitable. It is terrible.
In a separate attack, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society reports Israeli settlers shot dead a Palestinian ambulance driver south of Nablus as he was trying to reach Palestinians injured during a raid by Jewish settlers. For more, we go to Ramallah, to Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist. Her recent op-ed for Al Jazeera is headlined, "Palestinians and the World Must Not Lose Hope." Mariam, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can explain what happened over the weekend, not only just in the occupied West Bank overall.
Thanks for having me back, Amy. So what we have seen in the West Bank across the weekend and in general in this month is an intensification and escalation by the Israeli military as well as armed Israeli settlers that are trying to continue the illegal annexation of lands in the West Bank. The concentration of these attacks, as we have seen earlier, have been in Tul Kerem and Jenin, which is north of the West Bank. And that is because there is few youth groups that are engaging in armed confrontation. But as you have seen, the Israeli military, just as it is conducting in Gaza, is trying to focus on the attack of the civilian infrastructure. It is making any life for Palestinians unbearable, and it is using excessive violence and slaughter to do so. So what we are seeing is a disregard for Palestinian lives, and we are seeing it happen in the most brutal and savage ways that I don't think any of us really could have imagined. And over the weekend, Palestinians went on a strike yesterday in mourning of 14 Palestinians killed in one of the longest siege being conducted by the Israeli military on Nur Shams refugee camp. This is an attack on Palestinians that were already displaced from their homes in 1948, only to have the same army come back and attack the generations that came afterwards that chose to fight for life. 14 were killed, and of those, two were children, which is on brand for Israel. A fifth of all Palestinians killed in the West Bank were children. As we have seen in Gaza, where nearly half of all Palestinians killed are children and minors.
Can you talk about the significance of Nur Shams, the refugee camp there in Tul Karam?
The significance of Tul Karam and Nur Shams is like the significance of Jenin refugee camp, is like the significance of the old city in Nablus, in that it is it allows for youth who have refused to be silenced, who have witnessed the brutality engaged against them, from arrests under administrative detention by the Israeli military to the continuation of Israeli settler attacks. So you have the Nur Shams Brigade, and you have the Jenin Brigade, which is youth with very humble weapons that are no match for Israel's nuclear army, who have chosen to confront the Israeli military. And we need to keep in mind that the Israeli military went and engaged in an offensive and an attack on the refugee camp, and these youth engaged in confrontation to try and protect the refugee camp from the destruction. And what Israel did is go ahead and greenlight an attack on the civilian infrastructure in order to punish Palestinians in a punitive and collective measure, which again is part of Israel's policy in order to ensure the pushing out of Palestinians, in order to ensure the erasure of Palestinian existence, and to create the space to replace them by Israeli settlers.
Mariam, the Biden administration is reportedly preparing to issue sanctions on Netzah Yehuda, an ultra-Orthodox Israeli military unit accused of committing human rights abuses against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, has vowed to fight any sanctions on the battalion. The Guardian reports soldiers from the unit were accused in the death last year of Omar Assad, a 78-year-old U.S. citizen who died of a heart attack after being detained, bound, gagged, then abandoned by members of the unit. Can you tell us more about them?
I think in this regard, it's really fruitless to give more attention to the Biden administration's symbolic gestures that are very hollow. Likewise, Benjamin Netanyahu is corrupt, known for corruption, has engaged in crimes against humanity. These sanctions mean nothing in light of the billions of dollars that the U.S. Congress just approved for Israel in support, again, for this military that is conducting crimes against humanity. And in regards to sanctions in order to preserve citizenship rights, right, the dual citizen, let's go back to Shireen Abu Aqle, who is a journalist, was wearing a press vest that had the press insignia on it and still was shot and killed on May 11th, 2022 by the Israeli military. And until now, no accountability was held. None for Shireen Abu Aqle, who is press, who is a dual citizen with the United States and Palestinian. So the Biden administration is really trying to scurry using these words like sanctions while putting amendments of it's against a select few. It's not, it should not be against a select few. This entire regime is engaging in crimes against humanity, and it is U.S. sponsored. It is being paid for by American tax dollars, and the U.S. is also sending soldiers on the ground to engage in these crimes. So I think these are just hollow.
I also wanted to get your response to the breaking news that Israel's chief of military intelligence has resigned. Major General Aharon Haliva is the first senior Israeli official to resign over Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel. In a statement, he said his office, quote, did not live up to the task we were entrusted with. Many see this as a direct hit on Benjamin Netanyahu, calling for him to resign as well.
I think Halevi's resignation, again, is telling of how the Israeli security institution is failing. It has constantly tried to showcase to the world that it is an institution that provides national security when it is an institution that perpetuates crimes of persecution and apartheid. And what is happening now is resignation is an attempt to evade future accountability as a commander or as a senior position in this institution of repression and abuse. So again, I see it as an evasion of accountability for what is to come, because Israel is committing and engaging in crimes of genocide in not just Gaza, but in the West Bank, and as well as against Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, where the Israeli police shot and killed four Palestinians with Israeli citizenship so far.
Finally, Mariam Barghouti, I wanted to ask you about the attack on journalists. You mentioned Shirin Abu Akleh, who was killed May 11th, 2022. But I wanted to ask you about the other journalists. I mean, it's about 100 Palestinian journalists who've been killed since October 7th.
Thank you for asking that, Amy. The numbers are actually higher than that. It's closer to 135 Palestinian media personnel being attacked and killed since October 7th by the Israeli military. And this is really important because what Israel is doing is targeting journalists. It is not accidental. It is a strategic attack with precision in order to attempt and control the narrative of what is happening on the ground. And, you know, as Palestinian journalists, there's not a lot, right? There's few media personnel. So this attack is very dangerous because the more and more we're risking our lives, the more and more we're getting killed, with the impunity being provided to Israel, then more and more it is able to try and control the narrative and dub its attack and its attempt at erasing Palestinians as self-defense, when it is de facto the slaughter and ethnic cleansing of a population under the pretext of defense.
Mariam Barghouti, I want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian journalist in the occupied West Bank and Ramallah. We'll link to your piece at Al Jazeera, Palestinians and the World Must Not Lose Hope. As many as 300 protesters were arrested in Brooklyn on Tuesday night, where thousands of mostly Jewish New Yorkers gathered for a Seder in the streets to stop arming Israel, they said. This on the second night of Passover. The demonstration was held at Grand Army Plaza, one block away from the home of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. It came just hours before the Senate overwhelmingly approved a $95 billion foreign aid package that includes some $14 billion in arms and security funding to Israel. A series of speakers addressed the rally, including journalist and author Naomi Klein, Palestinian activist Linda Sarsour, and several Jewish students suspended from Columbia University, where students have held a Gaza solidarity encampment. These are some of the voices of the demonstrators yesterday speaking at the Seder in the streets.
Tonight's Seder in the streets, which will be happening on the second night of Passover, which is a holiday we observe every year that is all about liberation and how our liberations are intertwined with one another, is coming just hours ahead of a likely Senate vote on $14 billion in military funding and weapons to Israel. So we're here to tell Senator Schumer that this is enough and we need to end U.S. complicity in Israel's genocide against Palestinians. And at the core of the Passover story is that we cannot be free until all people are free. And right now, what we're seeing is that the Israeli government and the United States government are carrying out a genocide of Palestinians in Gaza, over 34,000 people killed in 6 months, in the name of Jewish safety, in the false name of Jewish freedom.
Will not go on. We are here at the doorstep of Senator Chuck Schumer. To the people in Palestine, we love you. We are with you. We are going to stop this U.S. funding so that you can fight for your own liberation.
If you do not move, you will be arrested.
some of the voices at the Seder in the streets to stop arming Israel that was held at Grand Army Plaza on Tuesday, on the second night of Passover. Among those who addressed the crowd during the Seder was award-winning author and activist Naomi Klein. This is some of what she had to say.
My friends, I've been thinking about Moses and his rage when he came down from the mount to find the Israelites worshiping a golden calf. The eco-feminist in me has always been uneasy about this story. What kind of God is jealous of animals? What kind of God wants to hoard all the sacredness of the earth for himself? But there is, of course, a less literal way of understanding this story. It is a lesson about false idols, about the human tendency to worship the profane and shiny, to look to the small and material rather than the large and transcendent. What I want to say to you this evening at this revolutionary and historic Seder in the streets is that too many of our people are worshiping a false idol once again. Yes. They are enraptured by it. They are drunk on it. They are profaned by it. And that false idol is called Zionism. Yes. It is a false idol that takes our most profound biblical stories of justice and emancipation from slavery, the story of Passover itself, and turns them into brutalist weapons of colonial land theft, roadmaps for ethnic cleansing and genocide. It is a false idol that has taken the transcendent idea of the promised land, a metaphor for human liberation that has traveled across faiths to every corner of this globe, and dared to turn it into a deed of sale for a militarist ethnostate. Political Zionism's version of liberation is itself profane. From the start, it required the mass expulsion of Palestinians from their homes and ancestral lands in the Nakba. From the start, it has been at war with collective dreams of liberation. At a Seder, it is worth remembering that this includes the dreams of liberation and self-determination of the Egyptian people. This false idol of Zionism has long equated Israeli safety with Egyptian dictatorship and unfreedom and client state. From the start, it has produced an ugly kind of freedom that saw Palestinian children not as human beings, but as demographic threats. Much as the Pharaoh in the book of Exodus feared the growing population of Israelites and thus ordered the death of their sons. And as we know, Moses was saved from that by being put in a basket and adopted by an Egyptian woman. Zionism has brought us to our present moment of cataclysm, and it is time that we say clearly, it has always been leading us here. It is a false idol that has led far too many of our own people down a deeply immoral path that now has them justifying the shredding of core commandments. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet. The commandments brought down from the mount. It is a false idol that equates Jewish freedom with cluster bombs that kill and maim Palestinian children. Zionism is a false idol that has betrayed every Jewish value, including the value that we place on questioning, a practice embedded in the Seder itself with its four questions asked by the youngest child. It also betrays the love that we have as a people for text and for education. Today, this false idol dares to justify the bombing of every single university in Gaza, the destruction of countless schools, of archives, of printing presses, the killing of hundreds of academics, scholars, journalists, poets, essayists,
This is what Palestinians call scholasticide, the killing of the infrastructure and the means of education. Meanwhile, in this city, the universities call the NYPD and barricade themselves against the grave threat posed by their own students, asking them... Students embodying the spirit of the Seder, asking the most basic question, asking questions like, how can you claim to believe in anything at all, least of all us, while you enable, invest in, and collaborate with this genocide? The false idol of Zionism has been allowed to grow unchecked for far too long. So tonight we say, it ends here. Our Judaism cannot be contained by an ethnostate, for our Judaism is internationalist by its very nature. Our Judaism cannot be protected by the rampaging military of that ethnostate, for all that military does is sow sorrow and reap hatred, including hatred against us as Jews. Our Judaism is not threatened by people raising their voices in solidarity with Palestine across lines of race, ethnicity, physical ability, gender identity, and generations. Our Judaism is one of those voices and knows that in this chorus lies both our safety and our collective liberation. Yes. Judaism is the Passover, is the Judaism of the Passover Seder, the gathering in ceremony to share food and wine with loved ones and strangers alike. This ritual, light enough to carry on our backs, in need of nothing but one another, we don't need walls, we need no temple, no rabbi, and there is a role for everyone, including, especially, the smallest child. The Seder is portable, a diaspora technology, if ever there was one. It is made to hold our collective grieving, our contemplation, our questioning, our remembering, and our reviving and rekindling of the revolutionary spirit. So tonight, look around. This here is our Judaism. As waters rise and forests burn and nothing is certain, we pray at the altar of solidarity and mutual aid, no matter the cost. We don't need or want the false idol of Zionism. We want freedom from the project that commits genocide in our name. We want freedom from the ideology that has no plan for peace except for deals with murderous theocratic petrostates next door while selling the technologies of robo-assassinations to the world. We seek to liberate Judaism from an ethnostate that wants Jews to be perennially afraid, that wants our children afraid, that wants us to believe that the world is against us so that we go running to its fortress, or at least keep sending the weapons and the donations. That is the false idol. And it's not just Netanyahu. It's the world he made and the world that made him. It's Zionism.
That's right.
We, in these streets for months and months, we are the exodus from Zionism. Yes. So, to the Chuck Schumers of this world, we do not say, let our people go. We say, we have already gone, and your kids, they're with us now.
Award-winning journalist and author Naomi Klein, speaking at what was called the Seder in the Streets to Stop Arming Israel on Tuesday at Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn, a block from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's home. Special thanks to Hannah Elias, Eric Halverson, and Ishmael Darrow of Democracy Now!
I was appalled to learn that in April, Colombia suspended and evicted six students for their involvement in the pro-Palestinian panel event on campus.
There's a bit of a weird situation going on at Columbia University, where Isra Hirsi, the daughter of Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar, was just suspended by the university a day after Ilhan Omar spoke up in questioning against the president of Columbia University. Now, there's a lot more to this story. It involves this encampment that was just recently set up at Columbia. Let me play for you a couple of videos that show you this. So this was posted by Talia Jane. This encampment was erected at 4 in the morning, apparently. So they're going to show how it... There. So at 4 in the morning... students came out setting this up, all these tents. And there you go. So this was shared by People's Dispatch. I want to give them credit here because I believe this is their video. They talked to Isra Hirsi shortly after the encampment was set up, and she explains what this is all about.
We are in a huge historic moment right now. I think it's very important for students to organize around Gaza, not only because of the act of genocide going on, but because we've learned that protest is not enough. The university is not listening to us, and we find that escalation similar to what happened in 1968 following our predecessors, our ancestors, and those before us has really showcased that in order for our demands and our calls to be seen and heard, we have to take up space. We have to be visible, and we have to really force the university's hand. And that's what we've done here today.
And what's your message to Minister Peak in Colombia? Right. And why this timing? What's happening now?
Right now, Shafiq and the Board of Trustees, the chairs of the Board of Trustees, are answering at an anti-Semitism hearing about their lack of response to the cries of anti-Semitism. We find that Manoush and the Board of Trustees being put up on a large scale allows for us to really amplify our demands and really anchor ourselves in them, which is calling for divestment from companies that invest in the genocide in Palestine, amnesty for all students, including the five students that were already suspended from Columbia, as well as full transparency of Columbia University's investments. And we believe that these are very in tune with the things that Shafiq will be saying today around student repression, around student protests, and around our freedom of speech.
All right, so this is right in line with protests over the Vietnam War, over the Iraq War. History and, I mean, many at the time knew they were on the right side of history, but history has proven those activists to be correct. These students here are clearly on the right side of history, and this has led to their suspension. So, and I'll get to Ilhan Omar's comments or questioning of the president yesterday. But Isra Hirsi writing on Twitter here, "I'm an organizer with CU Apartheid Divest. In my 3 years at Barnard College, I've never been reprimanded or received any disciplinary warnings. I just received notice that I'm one of three students suspended for standing in solidarity with Palestinians facing a genocide. Those of us in Gaza solidarity encampment will not be intimidated. We will stand resolute until our demands are met. Our demands include divestment from companies complicit in genocide, transparency of Colombia's investments, and full amnesty for all students facing repression." Now, there are some images here from the suspensions and arrests, just to give you an idea what was going on here. So, I mean, this is just a day later, the university sending in the police to arrest some of these students, or at the very least, apparently now suspending all of them. So initially, as she said here, she was one of three. Isra Hirsi was one of three students. Then Barnard said it had temporarily suspended some of Columbia and Barnard students who refused multiple written and verbal requests to leave an unauthorized encampment on the lawn and that there were more than 100 people occupying the area. Then they updated later, Columbia announcing Thursday afternoon that it was suspending all the students in the encampment. Quote, we are continuing to identify them and will be sending out formal notifications from a that's from a spokesperson. So, look, I can't, I'm not going to claim that this question here, which I'm going to show you, is the reason that this happened. I don't think it is. But it is bizarre timing that the day before you have Isra Hirsi's mother, Ilhan Omar, questioning the president of Columbia University. Check this out.
There has been a rise in targeting and harassment against anti-war protesters because it's been pro-war and anti-war protesters is what it seems like, correct?
Correct. There has
been... Okay, thank you. Activists on campus, including Jewish students, Black and Brown, Arab and Muslim students. How many of the organizations that were canceled in Columbia involved Jewish students?
One of the organizations is called Jewish Voices for Peace.
Yes. And encompassed of Jewish students?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. There was a there's been a recent attack on the democratic rights of students across the country. I was appalled to learn that in April, Columbia suspended and evicted six students for their involvement in the pro-Palestinian panel event on campus. It happened that all six students were arbitrarily targeted after the university brought in a team of private and former police investigators. These investigators harassed, intimidated Palestinian students at their homes, demanding to see students' private text messages, and sent threatening emails to the leaders of those pro-Palestinian groups.
And then, bizarrely, a day later, her daughter is suspended from Columbia. Or I should say from Barnard College, which is a part of Columbia University, for protesting the university. Now, just to show you, this was apparently taken. This was shared by Sabas. Update: students have taken to the streets to prevent the corrections buses with the students from leaving. Student bodies on the side of the encampment in Palestine. So you have here students blocking the correction buses from leaving after taking all the students off of the lawn. Look, as I said earlier, history will prove these students to be correct. I think it's obvious now that they're on the right side of history. They want some accountability from the university, and they are correct to do so. There's no violence here. These are peaceful protests. The easy way, or the maybe not the easy way, but the simpler way, the more logical and rational and humane way to put an end to the encampment is to simply do what they're being asked to. Divest. Showcase that they are not investing in various organizations that are in support of the apartheid government. But the university, of course, is unwilling to do that.
Amidst crackdowns on pro-Palestinian voices on campuses coast to coast in the United States, we begin today's show in Israel, where police arrested the internationally renowned feminist Palestinian professor Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian at her home in Jerusalem Thursday on charges of incitement to violence. The professor holds both Israeli and U.S. citizenship. She was suspended by Hebrew University last month after saying in an interview Israel was committing genocide in Gaza. But then the university reinstated her. She spoke on Democracy Now! In March, after her suspension.
The question remains whether what is teachable, what is what should be written, what is publishable, what we can speak as scholars that are studying state criminality as opposing to what is going on, as opposing to what the state is doing is not accepted, so they throw us out of the university. And this is the same policy that the state of Israel is doing outside. So it's silencing, it's preventing people from speaking, it's threatening, it's punishing, and it's also done in a very degraded and indignifying manner, calling my student a day before the end of the first semester and telling me you're suspended, is something that is beyond any expectations. But this is and stressing it's a Zionist institution. You can't abide by these rules, you're out. My only concern, Amy, today is the safety of students, the safety of my students, Jewish and Palestinian, that are standing against genocide, standing against the war, refusing to see the continuous and ongoing atrocities. My really concern is the silencing of dissent all over the world, because we see it in academic institutions. The question, if we think that academic institutions should work according and by the orders from the state, I don't know why we're having academic institution. Academia and research requires that we're attentive to details, to what goes on, to the life of women, men, children. And I'm really concerned today. And of course, I must clearly state that the behavior of the university is a behavior that is threatening the safety of our students, the safety of colleagues that are speaking against the genocide, and my own personal safety as a person who lives in Jerusalem, and the safety of my family.
That was last month. After Professor Shahoub Kevorkian's arrest on Thursday, over 100 professors around the world released a statement calling for her immediate release, calling her arrest an attack, quote, on all Palestinian scholars, students, and activists who bring to light the violent and genocidal nature of the Israeli state, they wrote. Today, Professor Shahoub Kevorkian had a hearing where a judge ordered her release, but she has not been released, as the Israeli government is reportedly appealing. For more, we're joined by Sara Ihmoud, a Chicana Palestinian anthropologist, assistant professor of anthropology and peace and conflict studies at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. She's founder of the Palestinian Feminist Collective. Professor Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian is her mentor. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Professor Ihmoud. If you can start off by giving us the latest. We spoke to her when she was in London after being suspended by Hebrew University. They then reinstated her. She went home to Israel, and she has now been arrested. What have you heard of this hearing and why she was arrested?
Thanks for having me, Amy, and thank you for bringing light to the case of Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian, who, as you noted, is an internationally renowned feminist scholar and human rights activist who has been working to bring attention to the situation of Palestinian women and children under Israeli military occupation for the past three decades. As far as we understand, Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian was violently arrested from her home in the Armenian quarter of Jerusalem's Old City yesterday around 5 p.m. The police raided her home and confiscated her belongings, including her laptop, some books, from what I understand, as well as a poster of the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian, as you noted, has been subjected to violent repression and harassment by the Hebrew University for speaking out against the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And she was suspended from her teaching duties in March, though later reinstated once it became clear that there was no basis for the allegations against her. Ultimately, we hold the Hebrew University of Jerusalem responsible for her arrest and detention because of its persistent and public repression of her academic freedom, which led directly to yesterday's arrest. And we see this as yet another example of Israel attacking Palestinians wherever they are, whoever they are. It underscores that no Palestinian is safe under Israel's racist apartheid rule, not even someone like Dr. Shalhoub Kevorkian, who is both an Israeli and American citizen, and a world-renowned and respected feminist scholar. And it's important to note as well that Israel routinely holds Palestinians captive and imprisons them without trial, without due process, and under inhumane conditions, including children, and that this is just both unjust and illegal. And this is an attack on her as both a Palestinian and a scholar who is rightfully speaking out against Israel's well-documented human rights abuses and ongoing genocide. So as far as we understand, The Jerusalem court magistrate had ordered her release under the condition of a 20,000 shekel bail. However, the court, the state, and the police are appealing, and they have taken her to the central court where they're still holding her. So we are still awaiting further details about whether she will be released or whether the state will continue holding her.
Can you talk about how you know her, Professor Sada Ehmoud?
Of course. Thank you, Amy. I have known Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian for over a decade. I first met her in Occupied East Jerusalem when I was a graduate student just beginning to pursue my PhD dissertation research. And she has become one of my dearest friends and mentors over the past decade. She's someone that has really opened my eyes and many across the world to the intimacies of Israeli settler colonial violence and repression in Occupied East Jerusalem and across the Palestinian territory. Her work has focused on specifically the conditions of women, how patriarchy and colonialism intersect to shape the lives of women, and what justice looks like for Palestinian women. And her work has also really taken a central imperative to understanding the conditions of Palestinian children and speaking out against the persistent human rights abuses of Palestinian children in occupied territory. She is the scholar who founded the concept of unchilding to help us further understand, as scholars across the world interested in children's rights, how settler colonial states typically shape the lives and limit the futures of children, indigenous children and racialized children across the globe. So her work has been absolutely pathbreaking and important, not only in the Palestinian context, but in global contexts where populations are facing racialized and gendered repression and violence. And she has been a beloved mentor to many, including myself. And she has always centered love in the way that she cares for her students, for scholars in her community, and she continues to center that ethics and method of love in the work that she does in the community and with her students across the Hebrew University and beyond.
In addition to being a professor at Hebrew University, she also taught at Queen Mary University in London. We spoke to her in London. Another professor there is Niamh Gordon, the Israeli scholar who we also recently did an interview with. He just tweeted, the judge, Nadra hearing, the judge to police, I can understand that you wanted the arrest to conduct searches, but so far you have not found anything that justifies the arrest, and I have not received any other explanation. The pages you found are an expression of opinion, the judge said. As we wrap up, Professor Ehmoud, the significance of this and why you feel she's being targeted right now.
Absolutely. Thank you. I think, you know, it's important to stress the absurdity of her portrayal by the police as dangerous. And yet this follows a history of Palestinians generally and Palestinian women in particular being portrayed as a dangerous threat to Israeli security. Obviously, we see how the entire population of Gaza has been dehumanized, and that has provided the pretext for Israel's continued genocidal assault on the entire civilian population of the Gaza Strip. And of course, Israel sees Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian is dangerous because her work for the last several decades exposes exactly the opposite, of course. That is the humanity of the Palestinian people in the face of the inhumanity of the Israeli state in its quest to continue to occupy, terrorize, and brutalize the Palestinian people and repress our movement for liberation. So we are calling on international scholars, activists, and people of conscience everywhere to continue maintaining pressure for her immediate release and for all of the charges against her to be dropped. We are outraged by this unlawful action, and we refuse the continuing silence and violence by the Israeli state and its institutions against the Palestinian people and for those who, like Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian, continue being a voice of light and love, standing for justice and liberation. Again, Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian has always centered her love for her people, for her students' safety and security, and it's important that we follow in her footsteps, in the path that she has been taking herself and leading us in embodying hope and the necessity that we continue speaking out against Israel's ongoing genocidal violence.
Sada Ahmoud, we want to thank you for being with us. Chicana, Palestinian anthropologist, assistant professor of anthropology and peace and conflict studies at the College of Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, where she's speaking to us from. She's a founder of the Palestinian Feminist Collective. Professor Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian was arrested Thursday in Jerusalem at her home.
I don't take any lessons from the leader of the opposition when it comes to how people, marginalized people, feel. I'm an Italian-Canadian.
Oh my gabagool, there is some madness going on in the Ontario legislature. So, a conservative MPP today claimed that he understands the discrimination that marginalized groups like Palestinians are facing because he is Italian. And he so deeply understands that discrimination that he is with the party that is currently supporting a ban on the keffiyeh. Now, I'm going to try to break down what is going on here, what's been going on in Ontario over the past couple of weeks over the keffiyeh. This is such a wild story because the speaker is the one that brought in this ban, banning the wearing of the keffiyeh in the Ontario legislature, which led to even Doug Ford, the leader of the Conservatives, urging a reversal on that ban. So he went on to, and there's more to that, by the way, but here is what he said.
Well, the keffiyeh goes back to the 7th century, but it really comes down to uniting Ontarians and communities. We see the division right now that's going on. It's not healthy, and this would just divide the community even more. So I stand by that, and we'll bring it to the legislature.
All right, so I'm going to get to a little more backstory as to why Doug Ford is on the correct side here. Because when I first saw that he was against this ban, I was stunned. And then I learned a little more, which helped to explain why he is maybe, very likely, on the correct side of this issue. But this is the NDP, Ontario's NDP leader, Merritt Stiles, who tweeted out today, "I sought unanimous consent in the legislature to reverse the keffiyeh ban at Queen's Park. It did not go through. Some members of the Conservative government voted against the motion. Premier Ford needs to make sure that his team is doing the right thing." So this was from, I believe, the 18th. Let me play just a bit of this.
On April 12th, I received a letter from the leader of His Majesty's loyal opposition. She asked that I permit the wearing of the keffiyeh in the assembly. As always, any member may seek the unanimous consent of the House to wear clothing, buttons, ribbons, etc., which may fall outside the established rules or customs of the House. If a member sought unanimous consent to wear a keffiyeh, and if the House were to grant such consent, I would obviously accept the decision of the House.
That I seek unanimous consent.
So just to be clear there, that's the Speaker saying that if the legislature votes, you know, against him and supports bringing the keffiyeh back in or allowing the keffiyeh to be worn, then he would support what the members decide.
Consent that this House acknowledge that the keffiyeh is a culturally significant clothing item to many in Ontario's Palestinian, Muslim, and Arab communities, and should neither be considered an expression of a political message nor an accessory likely to cause disorder, and should therefore be permitted to be worn in the House.
Agreed?
No.
I heard some no's.
And that was it. So, Colin DeMello of Global News here writing, Doug Ford is giving PC MPPs a free vote on the keffiyeh ban issue, meaning he doesn't really care if he's allowing his MPs to do whatever the hell they want. What's important to him is keeping up appearances here. And again, I'll get to you later on as to why that is. So if he cared enough about this issue, then he would be whipping the votes to ensure that the keffiyeh is allowed. But MPP Robin Martin has signaled that she's going to vote against an attempt to reverse the ban at Queen's Park. So Robin Martin is in support of banning the keffiyeh. Going on to say here, the rules of the legislature are clear that props and clothing that make a political statement cannot be worn in the chamber. Interestingly, she wears dog tags, which I have no issue with. But under her own definition, props and clothing that make political statements, how do dog tags not fall under that? Of course they fall under that. That's under her own definition, that is a prop making a political statement. As Dave Moskrop writes here, the dog tag necklace is political. It's a prop, and it should be banned from the legislature. That's the logic of those who support a keffiyeh ban anyway. So what's the rule here? Of course there's no consistency. Of course. So this goes to today. It was the motion to allow it was voted down again, failed a second time. And that's when we get to this incredible moment. This is an exchange between, you're going to see NDP leader Merritt Stiles and then the PC MPP, who I'll get to a little more on in a second.
You know, this morning I planned to meet with the Arab Canadian Lawyers Association, but as they walked into Queen's Park, they were barred from entering this building because of their cultural attire. In this week alone, the Premier made a public declaration about the need to reverse the keffiyeh ban, but his members blocked it. He's admitted he thinks his own post-secondary legislation is an overreach, but his minister doubled down and forced him to recant. Question period is just not long enough for me to capture the full list of this government and this Premier's policy reversals and flip-flops. Ontarians are the ones that are paying the price here. Is the government caucus losing faith in their Premier, or has the Premier lost faith in his caucus?
And to reply, the government house leader.
Mr. Speaker, I think the Leader of the Opposition shows today why she can never lead the province of Ontario, because what she has chosen to do, Mr. Speaker, is to attempt to divide Ontarians, Mr. Speaker. I come from a caucus that is the most diverse caucus in the history of this province, Mr. Speaker. I don't take any lessons from the Leader of the Opposition when it comes to how people, marginalized people, feel. I'm an Italian-Canadian who in the 1970s was spit on for being a wop. I don't need any lessons from her on what it means to stand up for marginalized people. I do it every single day, and so do the rest of my caucus mates, and we bring people together. We don't divide them.
This righteous indignation is absolutely incredible. Because if you want to, let's take his word. He was discriminated against. He was spit on because he was Italian. That makes you look worse, because that experience clearly did not develop any empathy within you to be able to relate to others who are currently being discriminated against, as your party is the one supporting the ban on the keffiyeh. How do you use your experience as an Italian and use it to apply to a situation where you are on the wrong side of the discrimination? So it's just like, did that just completely fly over his head? Not to mention, I mean, the comparison's a little ridiculous. Please, comparing Italians to Palestinians and what they're currently going through. I mean, do I have to, let's just briefly touch on some of this. Daily, this is from January, by the way. Daily death rate in Gaza higher than any other major 21st century conflict. And we don't even have accurate numbers now because of the mass destruction that the apartheid Israeli government has caused in Gaza. There is no ability to accurately count the people that have either their lives have been lost, or they've been forced to move, or injuries. There is no ability in place. There's no infrastructure in place to be able to accurately assess all of that anymore anyways. From the UN, UN experts appalled by reported human rights violations against Palestinian women and girls. That's from February as well. As this from NPR, Gaza's death toll now exceeds 30,000. Here's why it's an incomplete count. And that goes to what I was saying, where, again, we don't know what the actual number is. There's estimates that are around 100,000. We simply don't know because there is no ability to accurately count at all. If you think the keffiyeh is a political statement, wearing that or allowing people to wear that is a political statement, to me that says more about your politics, where you view politics more as a game, more as, oh, you take this position, I take this position, as opposed to human life, in support of human life. Like, you could try and argue that the keffiyeh is... wearing the keffiyeh is making a political statement. But to me, that's simply arguing that supporting human life is making a political statement. I don't think supporting human life is making a political statement. You may think it is. I think that's just being human. Now, this gets to the apology that, this apology was for wealthy real estate developers. Yeah, no, he didn't apologize for making that ridiculous comparison. No, he apologized to wealthy real estate developers for being caught after their Greenbelt fiasco. So I did a lot of videos on the whole Greenbelt thing. Go back and watch that. Now, this gets to last thing to end on here. Why Doug Ford is on the correct side. This is from the Toronto Sun. So I'm not going to quote Brian Lilly on many things ever. But when it comes to the perspective of conservatives, him being one, he's probably correct here. In Milton's by-election, Gaza is dominating, not local issues. So this goes to likely why Ford is saying the right things here. Ford didn't do this for reasons of principle. He did it because he's worried about the result in the Milton by-election. So, of course, Brian Lilly is against the Kefia. He wants it banned. So he is defending Ford here by saying he's doing it for politics. That's his defense of Doug Ford, saying that Doug Ford's doing this for political reasons, his way of defending Doug Ford. He also did this after telling his caucus not to say or post anything to social media about the Middle East until after the by-election. So Doug Ford is worried about a by-election in Milton that is being impacted by discussions around Gaza and wants to sort of just not upset certain voting blocks that may be upset by the conservatives' position on this, which is why, again, Doug Ford on the correct side, even though he's not doing enough to get the rest of his party to be on the correct side of this.
In this high-tech digital age, with high-definition television, digital radio, all we get is static. That veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality. When what we need the media to give us is the dictionary definition of static, criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Quebec-raised singer Andrea Superstein is one of the most versatile voices in music today. The new album, Oh Mother, is an ambitious tour de force, highlighting her ever-growing creativity and sensitivity as a songwriter and arranger. Oh Mother is available now. Andrea will be performing at Upstairs Jazz Club in Montreal on Friday, May 3rd. For more information about the show, visit upstairsjazz.com.
Montreal at CKUT on 90.3 FM, my bad. So yeah, today it's going to be a show all about CanCon or Canadian content.